trade talks between the U.S. and China are in danger of hitting an impasse. We're talking about what this means for Wisconsin's economy and the world here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump is renewing his trade attack on China, calling the nation cheaters. Last week, speaking before the Economic Club of New York,
we'll soon be up to $100 billion in tariffs. And you haven't seen inflation, and you haven't seen, in many cases, price increases. Our farmers, because I have a very good relationship with our farmers, our great American farmers, I call them patriots, they were hurt very badly by China because China targeted them because they were my vote.
Have higher tariffs affected your company or your crop? Is your company a large importer of steel and aluminum? We're at 800-642-1234. Van Mobley is a history and economics professor at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's president of the Village of Thiensville. Van, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be back, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the Trump administration's trade deal with Canada and Mexico to replace NAFTA, USMCA. So this deal, still under review by House Democrats. I understand House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is meeting today with Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer to get this deal going here. We had talked with Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who had raised concerns about provisions on labor laws and medicine and the environment. And then we also talked with Congressman Ron Kind, who also echoed enforcement concerns.
The agreement that was negotiated by the administration was weak on enforcement. It's important that we have strong enforcement mechanisms in it. In case someone isn't abiding by the agreement, we have an ability to follow up then and make sure that they are, or to level sanctions against them if they are cheating in some way.
So, Van, why should the House pass the Trump administration's new trade deal?
Well, I think there are strong enforcement provisions in there. And you must remember that this deal is with really two of our closest allies, Mexico and Canada. And actually, it's in the context of an emerging, I think, in my own view, is it will be a permanent alteration in the way that our trade relations are with China. So I think that Mr. Lighthizer and the administration have listened very carefully to Democrats. They've moved toward the Democrats in many ways. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is a good deal. Nancy Pelosi has said repeatedly that she wants to get to yes. I think really they are at yes, and it's time for us to sign it on a bipartisan basis with the input that has been provided by the Democrats in multiple areas. And I think that we're about to do that, and I look forward to be actually, I mean, it'd be nice if it would be before Thanksgiving, but probably by in mid-December or maybe earlier. So I think that it's going to go through. And I thought about, you know, whether I would say mean and nasty things about all the Democrats today or just say nice things. And I think, let's just say nice things. This is a bipartisan accomplishment. And I think all Americans could be happy for it, particularly farmers in Wisconsin, because this does have some special provisions that will allow them greater access for dairy products, for example, into Canada. But I also think that the agreement, in addition to being good for manufacturers, is also good for farmers in particular. And on the enforcement
let's look at the enforcement here for a moment, because that is the key sticking point to enforce these labor laws and for strong punishments, including the banning of imports if Mexico fails to meet labor laws. What do you see there?
Well, I think you won't get a complaint from me on that. I think if people violate trade laws, whether they're the Mexicans, the Canadians, or the Chinese, then we should have enforcement mechanisms in place to hold them accountable, which basically means, you know, some sort of a tariff barrier or a sanction. So I'm fine with it. I think that the Mexicans and the Canadians, to be honest with you, are more trustworthy and reliable than some of our other trading partners. And I think if you have in place the ability to sanction or fine them, I don't think that it will have to be used very often. But it may have to be used every now and then. So, I have no problem with that. I would point out, however, that the Democrats are really keen on really being mean to the Mexicans and Canadians, whenever they want, but not when they don't want. But these are our friends. They are the Mexicans. They are the Canadians.
Wait, where do you see that happening?
Well, it's like the immigration debate, that, you know, the ongoing immigration. Let's don't build a wall with them, but let's really make it easy to slap some counter sanctions on them. Well, I'm sure if you asked the Mexicans, they'd say, you know, the wall would be a lot less damaging to us than these, you know, really scrutinizing us and whacking us over the head with trade sanctions all the time. So, but as I said, I think that it's going to be fine. So I think that this is going to roll forward.
Talking with Van Mobley, a professor of history and economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can join in. Business owners, are you an exporter or importer? What has your experience been like with tariffs? Are you thinking about getting more involved with international trade? What do you want to know? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Van, national labor unions have been pushing against the trade agreement, worried about the loss of American jobs. Wisconsin has thousands of union workers in manufacturing. Should these workers be concerned about the trade deal?
I think they should actually be very optimistic about it. One of the big things that people don't talk about is, but I think that they should, is the what they call the regional content rules, which are actually going up. And what that means is a higher percentage of goods sourced in the United States have to be present, for example, in the automotive cars. I think that's good for the automotive industry. Those provisions also are included inside the with steel and aluminum in particular. So I think that those are very good. And I'm particularly on the automotive industry, which is a lot of the stuff. So there's some provisions that they really increase wages across the North American continent. And I think it's good. I mean, I really like the deal. There has been a great deal of Democratic input, and they've been, you know, sometimes the Republicans or in the business interest haven't necessarily liked some of the labor provisions that hike up some of the wages and then some of the content laws that make it, I think it went from like 60% to 70% has to be sourced in the North American continent. So I think that really we're just kind of pushing and screaming around the edges about how we're going to slice up the pie among the United States, Mexico, and Canada. But, you know, that's a pretty good that's like a nice family dispute that we're having, but we're going to resolve it because everybody's going to have a bigger piece. Everybody's going to have a bigger piece of pie, and I think it'll make the Mexicans and the Canadians and the Americans all very happy. I think it'll make the workers very happy, too. But I also think it'll make the business very happy because what they're going to have is they're going to have certainty. And the certainty is going to be of the type where they'll know that they need to begin to build the new manufacturing plants that they're going to be building in the next 5, 10, 15 years. They need to place them in North America. And I think American workers are the best in North America, but I do think the Mexicans and the Canadians are very good, and I don't begrudge them economic success. As a matter of fact, that's key to our success.
So how much does it matter whether this deal is approved today or months from now?
I think it matters because we're seeing is the renegotiation of our trading relationships, not only in North America, but across the globe. And I think the Trump administration has had a very good approach. And what you're seeing is now we're seeing North America fall into place. We've also got some new deals with Japan and Korea. I think the Japanese deal is very key in the sense that it will also allow us for some more agricultural products there. And that's very key because we're bringing our allies close to us. So this has a geopolitical component as well as an economic component, because I'm not optimistic about a continuation of the trade between the United States and China as it's been constructed over the last 20 years. As a matter of fact, I think we're moving away from that.
And let's pause there on China. We're going to get to China here in just a moment. Van Mobley, a history and economics professor at Concordia University, Wisconsin. And you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about President Trump's trade policy. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We see few signs of progress on U.S.-China trade talks. The U.S. Ambassador to China, Terry Branstad, was at the White House earlier this week. Two words from him on the status of talks: they're going. trade negotiators had originally hoped to sign a deal last weekend at an economic summit in Chile. That was called off. So what questions or concerns do you have about the state of trade negotiation as it looks like today? What do you want to know about trade policy and tariffs? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Van Mobley stays with us. He's a history and economics professor at Concordia University, Wisconsin. So, Van, on our program recently, we talked with Congressman Glenn Grothman, who seemed to praise President Trump's overall trade strategy, but he also gave mixed reviews of individual tariffs.
Insofar as he's going to try to do something with intellectual property, the patents and that sort of thing, I applaud him for that. I wasn't a big fan of the steel and aluminum tariffs, but it looks like we've gotten over the worst of the hump there.
So the steel and aluminum tariffs landed in May of 2018 and were dropped about a year later as part of the trade deal with Canada and Mexico. There was a lot of talk about this. Looking back, were they worthwhile?
Yes, and I think the provisions in the USMCA about steel and aluminum content are worthwhile. I simply disagree with Congressman Grothman, who I know. His mother lives right down my street, so I see him quite frequently. He's just wrong. The tariffs were useful. We have to maintain a steel and aluminum capacity in the United States. And we will. And if he thinks we'd be better off if all our steel and aluminum capacity went to people that we're slapping with all kind of sanctions like the Chinese, then I think he's just living on another planet. So you have to do what you have to do in cases of necessity. And this was one.
Well, let's shift to the trade war with China. Wisconsin farmers are under pressure from it, but you say other factors are playing a role in the farmers' challenges. How much can you attribute to the trade war right now versus other factors?
Well, I think that what you've seen, if you've seen the expansion of agricultural capacity in Brazil a great deal, and then that really, so there's, in some ways, there's been an over, much more agricultural production on basic commodities, in particular corn and soybean, then the world can soak up. This has been exacerbated by what I consider to be a necessary trade spat with the Chinese, which is going to continue, by the way. The House and Senate both passed bills that the Chinese do not like at all over the Chinese behavior in Hong Kong. And it's very difficult to sign a new expansive trade deal that will reduce trade barriers whenever we're saying the Chinese are not good actors. So if you have a problem of trusting the Mexicans and Canadians, there's no way on God's green earth you're going to trust the Chinese. And I think so we're going to be disentangling from them. And in that context, the Chinese have bought more stuff from the Brazilians than they otherwise, whereas they used to buy it a lot from the United States. But we should also remember that the Chinese have had a big hog problem. So a lot of their hogs are dying or are already dead, and therefore their need for basic agricultural commodities is much reduced. There have been a pickup in the sale of American pork and other people's pork to the Chinese. Their food markets are disrupted because of that hog thing, and we'll see how it shakes out. I've been in favor of the president's support for our farmers, and he has done that. He continues to do that. I actually expect that we'll do some other things. And one of the things that I've suggested, for example, is we should work with farmers and hunters and environmentalists on some new programs to maybe begin to take some farmland in the United States offline and use it more environmentally sound. And I think that that's a way that we could do that. And even if that's a longer-term program, and I think that would support prices and also make trade deals with our allies that allow for further expansions incrementally in our agricultural sales to them.
Talking with Van Mobley, a professor of history and economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Still time for you. What do you think about President Trump's approach on tariffs? We're at 800-642-1234. Van Mobley, we had U.S. Senator Ron Johnson recently and on our program criticizing President Trump's escalating trade war with China.
I don't believe anybody wins a trade war. I do believe that China is paying the highest price it is definitely affecting their economy far more than it is ours. So from that standpoint, if it's a relative thing, yeah, we're winning that one, but it still harms our economy.
So it still harms our economy. He went on to say it creates instability. You support the trade war with China, but that comes with a price, does it not?
Actually, in the long run, no, it could be better. And actually, for complicated economics reasons, I think that both economies were in danger of becoming over-specialized and over-dependent upon one another. And I think that in the long run, the tariffs will be useful for both the United States and China. Certainly in the United States, the tariffs have not prevented us from growing at a respectable rate. We have very low unemployment. We have wages at the bottom in particular that are going up. We also have revenue coming into the federal treasury that we didn't otherwise have. Now, all those are positive things, and I expect more of the same. So, and really, frankly, going forward, I think that probably we're going to, I don't know, we'll see what happens, and but I think that probably the tariffs will go up on that next tranche in mid-December. I think at the same time, if we do the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, I think that will give certainty to businesses that they know that the relationship between the United States and China will not be the same as it was in the past. And when they're making decisions about where they need to put their new factory, they'd better put it in North America, and they'd and I think that they will. And then we'll have certainty, which is what they've been crying out for. The certainty is that the world will be a little bit different than it was before. Well, and then we'll have had time to make adjustments.
Yeah, I want to take a look a little bit at the world before we look at the impeachment inquiry, because there are scholars out there who say that America hegemony has died, that the age of U.S. dominance in the world is over, and was the death of the U.S.'s status as a result of external causes, or was it happening because of Washington's behavior? So as you look at it, has the Trump administration lost trust with our allies, through tariffs, through the insults and the threats, withdrawing from the World Trade Organization, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement? That can't help us on the world stage when we're trying to negotiate trade.
Oh, on the contrary, I think that the United States is doing the appropriate policy. And I would say this, the trade that the United States had with the rest of the world from World War II until just recently was really a trade where we sacrificed our own national economic interest and we gave things away to the allies. Now, we're still being very nice to our major allies, Mexico, Canada, Japan, Korea. I think that after Brexit, we may very well get the Brits back in. But, some of these other people are not our allies. The Chinese are not our allies. The Europeans they could come back in, but they have to think about what they want to do, and it's not clear. And then other than that, I mean, what are you talking about that we're irritating our allies? The Middle East, anybody who wants to continue American intervention in the Middle East is fine to win an election on that basis, but they're not going to win. The United States is done. So that's what I think. You're doing a great job with our allies. Nancy could help by passing the USMCA.
Well, let's quickly go here to the impeachment inquiry. You believe President Trump would have been within his rights to block military aid for Ukraine unless the country's leaders agreed to investigate the Bidens, a political rival. Why would that be okay?
It would be okay because there was an appearance, at least, of a conflict of interest involved in Bidens, who were in charge of American policy toward Ukraine at the very start of this new Ukrainian government after they have a revolution. Now, at least we need to sort of air this thing, everybody look at it, and then after we look at it, we can move forward on a better basis. The other thing is, that's it. There's an appearance of conflict. We need to air it. We are airing it, and then we're going to move forward together.
So are you saying a president may use government resources like military aid for their own personal or political gain?
Well, in this case, there was no quid pro quo, but I don't know that that's his own personal gain. That's a national interest. So sometimes the personal and the national interest are combined, and that's it. So I don't see any problem with it.
But following the interests, following the interests of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, perhaps instead of the interests of the overall State Department on behalf of the United States of America.
I think that the president determines the national interest of the United States of America, not the State Department. It flows the other way. And then I would say, in this case, there was no quid pro quo, and they got their aid. And we've aired some past indiscretions, and we've all talked about it.
Van, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Van Mobley is a professor of history and economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Coming up, we look at how sleep deprivation affects people who work in emergency services, police officers, firefighters, ambulance drivers. Are you feeling sleep deprived in your job? Join in 800-642-1234. Back after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In a programming note here, the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue today, and live coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio continues as well. Our NPR News and Classical Music Network is broadcasting the hearings. That's live coverage of the public impeachment inquiry hearings on the NPR News and Classical Music Network and online at WPR.org. Right now, though, we're talking about the risks of sleep deprivation. A recent study published in the Journal of Community Health looked at trend lines in lack of sleep for different occupations. And the researchers found last year the highest levels of sleep deprivation were in the categories of police and military, healthcare support occupations, transportation, and production occupations. So this is data from the National Health Interview Survey. Do you work in law enforcement? Perhaps you're a firefighter or ER nurse. Do you feel sleep deprived due to your profession? We're at 800-642-1234. Josh Miller is an officer with the Eau Claire Police Department. He served with the department for nearly 10 years. Officer Miller, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
So as you look at your department, do you agree with what you see in this study? Are first responders, law enforcement workers, sleep deprived?
Yeah, I believe that study said that we were about 50% as far as people who are sleep deprived. I think they define that as about averaging less than 7 hours of sleep per night. And yeah, that sounds about right. Just thinking back to especially my years on patrol when I was working the streets, you combine kind of the strange hours that we had to work, you know, being a 24/7 job that patrol is, and you combine that then with the kind of the additional job duties, not just the patrol obligations, but other things that we have to do that can really bite into that time when you should be sleeping or would normally be sleeping. And yeah, nothing too surprising about what I saw in that study.
So you're on patrol, and then you also have back office duties, I'm sure paperwork as well to fill out. Take us back to the days when you were on patrol. How often did your schedules change? How predictable was your life?
Yeah, so in our particular department, the way that we do it is we have a shift for the entire year. We would bid on that by seniority at the beginning of the year. So right around October, we start planning for January. So in October, we would do what we call a shift draw, where we would start with our most senior officer, and they would pick the shift in the area that they want to work. Typically, that would then be the day shift. The senior officers would take a day shift, more of a more normalized routine, and then that would just kind of filter down to our less senior officers, and they would be kind of stuck with those kind of in between shifts. A lot of times, the midnight shift or the evening shift, like the 4:30 p.m. to 3 a.m. shift. So you're kind of stuck on that shift then for a year. So we do have the benefit of
for a year,
right? And then we would redraw the following year. So we do have the benefit of at least being able to sort of acclimate to that shift if we're not used to working it for a while.
Do people want to work an overnight shift? Do you find volunteers for that?
So, yeah, that is completely officer dependent. We have officers that have been on the midnight shift the entire time that they've been here. I think our most senior officer on MIDS now has been there for about 9 years and has never worked a different shift. He finds that just is the kind of work that he likes. It works well with his particular lifestyle and what he does at home, so he will stay on there. Other people, you know, can't wait to get off of that shift, and they can't wait to get to more normalized routine. So it's very dependent on the officer.
When was the last time you felt sleep deprived due to your job?
Yeah, so even when you say you move up to like a detective spot, which is a typical Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., you're never really entirely off the clock. In the case of like a major event where they need a detective to come in, we could be called at any time. We're not obligated to come in, but most guys want to come in. They want to do the job that they were hired for. So, we could get a call. We come home at 4 p.m. after doing our detective shift for the day. We're home for 3 hours. All of a sudden, we have a major event. We're just finishing up supper, maybe getting ready for bed, and we go to come deal with a problem, and we could be there literally all night. So it's just because you're in this more normal schedule, you're by no means shielded from these long kind of strange hours.
Are you concerned about officers falling asleep behind the wheel? Is that type of concern a reality we should be talking about?
I think anytime someone's sleep deprived is something that you want to be aware of. And especially when you look at the jobs that are named in this study, you've got protection services, police, military, and then healthcare workers. So obviously you prefer that your healthcare provider is not sleep deprived. But I guess I will say this: in the times that I was working patrol or when I came in for detective work, I don't ever recall necessarily when I'm on a call actually doing something, talking to someone, dealing with a situation, I didn't feel necessarily that sleep deprived at that time. It's in the downtime later on when everything kind of calms down and you sit down in your car and try to catch your breath. It's like, wow, I've been here a long time and I haven't slept in a while. That's when it tends to kind of catch up with you a little bit. But I mean, obviously you would prefer that people in these line of business is not sleep deprived, but the nature of the job, I think there's no way to avoid it, but we just have to look at how we can minimize it and how we can help officers get through it.
We're talking with Eau Claire Police Department Public Information Officer Josh Miller about the impact of sleep deprivation and how to help officers get rest. You can join in. Do you work at a job where you feel sleep deprived? What is your profession? How many hours a week do you work? How much sleep do you get on average? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So Harvard researchers back in 2011 looked at this. They looked into the life of police officers and found that sleep-deprived officers had a lot of risk involved. And one of the things they found, 1 in 3 had sleep apnea. And I'm wondering, is the stress and demands of the job affecting physical and mental health?
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of a chicken and egg question. Are officers having sleep problems because of the stress and the trauma of the job, are they having sleep problems because of the job, or is the job then causing those sleep problems? I think both of the problems kind of compound each other. If you're working a midnight shift or a late shift, it can be difficult to sleep during the day, and all the trauma and issues that we deal with at work, again, then make that also difficult to deal with. So you really have two kind of real forces pulling at you, and that you're working these odd hours, and when you're off, you're still mentally dealing with all the issues that you've dealt with at work.
How big of an issue is physical fitness in your job, and how do you see that in officers?
Yeah, obviously we put a stress on physical fitness. It's become kind of a focus in our department, not necessarily the physical fitness, although that's a component of it. Our department in particular has been really great about pushing the wellness factor for officers, and that's complete wellness, mental, emotional, and physical health. So, although being physically fit and being in shape can certainly help you, get through those times, there's a whole another litany of emotional and psychological factors that you have to be aware of. You know, the most physical fit person can get burned out seeing traumatic incidents day after day after day, and taking that home with you can just is not the healthy way to deal with it, certainly.
When there is a very traumatic incident that your officers have responded to, what happens after that incident? You know, barring that an officer hasn't gone on administrative leave or something like that. But what is the protocol after a trauma?
Sure. So, you know, I can think about a time in particular when I was a little bit of a younger officer. We had an officer involved shooting while I was on patrol, and it happened fairly early in my shift that night. I was working, I think, 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. at that time. And just because of the nature of it, we had so many officers involved, we had to call in a bunch of extra officers to come in and start taking the normal day-to-day calls in our city. And it just so happened that because so many people came in to help, I got released at 11 p.m. at the end of my normal shift. Well, after dealing with this massive incident, I go home at 11 p.m. and I'm by no means am I ready to go to sleep. Am I able just to lay my head down on my pillow and get ready to get up with my kids the next morning? I mean, I'm up thinking about what happened. This is the first officer-involved shooting that I'd ever seen or been involved in. So you can't just, as much as we tell our officers, you have to be able to leave work at work and come home and be your home person, I guess. It's nearly impossible. It's just a matter of how we cope with it. How do we deal with it? But we have resources available anytime that we have kind of a critical incident, and it doesn't have to be an officer involved shooting. It could be a particularly bad, maybe a fire. Maybe there's a really bad domestic assault, a sexual assault that we have to deal with. We will call in professionals to have what we call a critical incident stress debrief, and everyone's invited. Even if you're working, you can come in and be a part of it. Sit down, talk about it. You can be as involved as you want, but it's a great outlet for us to kind of get everything out there and talk about it, rather than bringing it home. It's a safe place for us to vent our feelings about it, to talk about how we're dealing with it, and then what to expect in the future as we go on. So,
do you find officers come to the table for that?
Again, that's really dependent on the particular officer, but for the most part, yes, most officers do enjoy going to those things. Like I said, even if you don't say anything and you don't talk about what you're going through, I think it's so helpful to hear from other people, what they're going through, what they experienced during this, to say, okay, yeah, that's exactly what I was going through, and that is normal. So it's, again, you're never going to be able to completely leave it at work, but there's some great tools out there to sort of help you distance yourself.
We're talking about the occupational hazards of sleep deprivation with Eau Claire Police Department Officer Josh Miller as our guide. Do you supervise emergency responders? How do you ensure your staff gets enough sleep? How much of a priority is this issue? Do you work at a job where you feel sleep deprived? What is your job? How many hours a week do you work? And what keeps you awake at night? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Officer Josh Miller here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a new study that flags emergency responders and members of the military as groups who could be more sleep-deprived than other occupations. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So according to the study, it's healthcare workers and law enforcement who sleep less than 7 hours a night. And this analysis used self-reporting of 150,000 adults. Do you work in law enforcement? What are your hours like? Do you feel overworked and, as a result, sleep deprived? What do you wish could change? Are you a physician? Are you sleep deprived, or do you work with sleep deprived patients? What does that affect? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The public information officer for the Eau Claire Police Department, Josh Miller, stays with us, and he's joining us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire this morning. Officer, right now your department in Eau Claire is experiencing a shortage of staff. You have 4 officer openings. How is that affecting your current officers?
Yeah, so 4 may not seem like a huge number, but it ends up being more than that, and I'll kind of explain. We have a set number of officers that by contract have to be on duty in the city, so we have a minimum number per shift, depending on the time of day. So you take 4 of those officers away that we don't have hired. Then you factor in things like vacations and trainings and injuries if somebody gets hurt or if they're on administrative leave or something like that. If we can't meet those minimum shift requirements, say we're going to be 1 short coming up on the midnight shift, we then have to hold one of our officers from the shift prior onto that shift for half of it, and then they'll have to call in an officer from the shift before to cover the other half of that shift. So if you're kind of a junior officer, say like on the afternoon shift where you can 10:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. and the midnight shift is going to be short, you may be getting held an additional 5 hours. So then you're working, we work 10 and a half hour shifts here, you're working 15 and a half hours, then leaving less time for you to, you know, get the kids on the bus, get, you know, supper made and get some sleep. So that small number of officers that we're missing and can really snowball pretty quickly to officers being held over and having to work additional time and thus leaving less time to sleep.
So if you've had to layer into a 15 and a half hour shift, do you expect that officer to be up and at him the next day? I mean, how can you expect that?
Right. So if we are held over on a shift like that by contract, we then have to have at least 6 hours off. And again, that's not a whole lot of time, but it's certainly better than having to do like a really quick turnaround of only 3 hours and then come back for a shift. So most people will tell you once you're out on patrol, yes, 15 hours is a long shift, but it's certainly manageable.
How difficult is it right now in the effort of recruitment? Can you recruit officers to your line of work?
Yeah, it's an ongoing challenge, obviously, and we're not alone in Eau Claire in dealing with this. It's nationwide that we're looking for candidates, and I know we're not the only department that has said, even though we're facing, you know, a smaller number of applicants, we're not going to change our hiring qualifications or who we look for. We absolutely have to have the right person. So that ultimately does put more stress on our department that we're not going to kind of lower our standards simply because we have less applicants. And, you know, it does trickle down and it does create more of a stress on our patrol division. But again, we think we're better serving our community by keeping our standards high and kind of sort of powering through, I guess you could say, until we find the right people to fill those spots.
How long might a vacancy, or 4 vacancies for that matter, be open?
It'll be ongoing. And even once we fill those spots, we'll probably have a couple more open due to retirement. And the process is very, very long. From the time that we meet someone, when they turn in their application, we could look at up to 9 months to a full year before they get hired for the interviews that they have to go through, the background process, and then the recruit school that they have to go to. I think over 700 hours of training. Then we put them through another, I think, 12 weeks of on the road training with the training officers. So again, it's a super long process, and it's a grind on the other officers, but we think that ultimately it's worth it just so we get the right people where they need to be.
Talking with Eau Claire Police Department Public Information Officer Josh Miller. He's with us as we look at the impact of sleep deprivation and really a domino effect on so many other things in the department. Do you work at a job where you feel sleep deprived? What is your profession? How many hours a week do you work? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Officer Miller, what protocols are in place? You mentioned, you know, at least 6 hours between shifts. That doesn't take into account that you have to drive home or get home and sleep and perhaps try to fall asleep. So by the time you're looking at those 6 hours between a shift, there's not much downtime there for real productive sleep.
No, there really isn't. And again, I'm not sure that there's a solution to that necessarily. What we do try to talk to our new officers about is how you deal with that. You know, making sure that your typical sleep hygiene, good habits, not staying away from alcohol before you try to sleep, staying away from caffeine, 4 to 6 hours before you sleep. And then, you also think about, we're not just talking about patrol shifts that people have to come into. If you're subpoenaed for court, if you have to go for court on something, you may work until 8 a.m., finish up your midnight shift and have to be back in court at 11 o'clock. And, you've got to make sure that you're making those hours count, because we need to be focused and ready to go for court. I mean, it could be court, it could be training, all sorts of things that we can come in for, not necessarily just for patrol. So it's important that I think our training officers are talking to our younger new officers about what they're doing in their spare time, how you get good sleep. I know most everyone that works a midnight shift is going to invest in blackout curtains to make sure that the sun's not getting in, that their family knows that, hey, mom or dad is going to be sleeping late today. They had a late night. So it's that open communication with your family, so they know that, hey, he may be here, but he's not available for the family right now.
Let's go to Rich now, joining us from Dallas, Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to comment on this. I was a volunteer firefighter, retired a couple years ago, spent 23 years in the service. We moved to northern Wisconsin. I lived in Illinois at the time. But, I drive truck for a living, and what the government regulates a 14-hour shift, and then there was a training, weekly trainings that we attended to, and it was obviously there's lots of state requirements as far as training and certifications and things along those lines, schooling. There's 80% of the United States firefighters in the country are all volunteers, so they have a full-time job, they have primary requirements, they have expectations, requirements from the department that they might want, the personal goals that they have to want to achieve.
So they're really layering on the volunteer firefighter on top of so many other duties. And Rich, it sounds like it really stretched you.
We raised four kids through the time. I should say my wife raised four kids. I was there, but not very active. I hate to say that, but she was very supportive. The family was very supportive. Our daughter is a firefighter, EMT. She does dispatch for the city she lives in now. So,
well, Rich,
there's a lot of requirements. There's a lot of personal commitment that goes along with that, and sleep deprivation. I mean, I can think of many times that I went to work with 2 to 3 hours sleep.
And we're short on time here, Officer Miller. Is there any suggestions you can give to people out there, emergency responders in particular, as you look at this issue?
Sure. I would definitely say, make sure you're reaching out to your resources. Your family's your best resource. You need to be open and upfront with them about, maybe why you're not sleeping well, or, what the requirements of the job are. Make sure that they know every step of the way what's going on. And then I would just stress to departments and administrators in general to take a look at your schedules to make sure that the schedule that you're people are working are to the best benefit for them. There's a lot of flexibility that the departments can apply in, the number of shifts and the length of shift and all that. So take a look at that and make sure you're doing what's best for your people.
Officer Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate it.
Josh Miller is an officer with the Eau Claire Police Department. We've been talking about the impact of sleep deprivation on first responders. He joined us from our Eau Claire studios. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.